Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, I'm pleased to share with you a conversation with a mental health advocate by the name of Kevin Hines, who is coming to Racine at the invitation of the 21st Century Preparatory School to speak at an event they're having on February 11th as part of their Dinner and Discussion Parent Community Series. February 11th, 4:30 in the afternoon, with his talk to begin at 5 at Infocino's Banquet Hall, which is 3201 Rapids Drive in Racine. We'll remind you of that information at the end of this interview. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we are going to be hearing the harrowing story of Kevin Hines, who has the distinction of being one of a very few people who have survived a suicide attempt off of the Golden Gate Bridge. He lived to tell the story in a very, very powerful memoir called Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. Kevin Hines has contended with mental illness for much of his life, but has come to terms with it in very inspiring fashion. And that is really the most important heart and soul of the matter. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with Kevin Hines for the next few minutes about his story. Kevin Hines, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg, very much. I appreciate it.
As you look back on your early life, when is it that the specter of mental illness first began to sort of rear its head? At what point did either you or the people that cared about you sense that something was amiss?
The main point when people sensed that something was wrong or off or imbalanced occurred at 17 and a half years of age, after dealing with epilepsy since fourth grade and having one grand mal seizure. They took me off of my epileptic medication, which happened to also be specific medication for mood disorders and for it was antidepressant as well. But the doctors at the time didn't know it had that secondary effect. And so when they took me off of this epileptic medication, and at the same time that my parents got divorced, I had a complete mental breakdown at 17 and a half in high school.
At that point in time, what were the resources open to you, and how open were people about something like mental illness? I mean, what were you able to do with this sobering reality at such a young age?
Well, I mean, I went to see a doctor, a psychiatrist, a psychologist, got on medication. I was encouraged to follow a treatment plan of things like exercise, proper diet, different therapies that were reputable and proven, education as to my disease. All of these things these tools were kind of given to me, but I didn't really follow them. So for the next 2 years, 17 and a half, 19, I was just going up and down in the constant throes of bipolar disorder, mania, and depression, along with hallucinations, both auditory and visual, terrible, awful paranoid periods of extreme paranoia. I was a mess. And my family, you know, this was their first experience having a significant loved one with severe mental illness or the potential for that. And they really didn't know what to do. You know, I was living with my father at the time, and his education about mental illness wasn't very vast, and he did the best he could. And so, you know, when I got to 19 years of age and it was spiraling out of control, the problem was that I kept it all inside. No one really knew the extent to which my psychosis was taking over my mind and, frankly, my body, because the brain is connected to everything below, and everything below is connected to the brain. And too often in this country and around the globe, we forget that the brain is just an organ, just like every other organ in the body. And when the brain gets diseased, you know, just like liver, lung, heart disease, the rest of you is going to be affected. But I kept the real devastation of this illness away from people. My family didn't know that I was experiencing hallucinations on a daily basis. My family didn't know that when my dad, you know, went to work, I would look in the mirror and talk to myself as if it was an entirely different person or more than one person. My family didn't know that when my dad was doing his work in his office, I was in my room pacing back and forth or in circles, talking to myself, hearing voices, seeing things, going up and down with mania and depression. And, you know, the mania was pretty clear, but what were they to do about that? That was the reality that they were faced with. And that, I think at that point, they did everything they could do with what they knew.
Was it a steady downward arc towards this moment a couple of years later when you, at the age of 19, found yourself standing on the Golden Gate Bridge attempting suicide? Or was there sort of a precipitous drop that triggered that move on your part?
In my case, I don't recall a particular trigger at that moment of despair where I told myself I had to die. I remember skyrocketing into mania and falling into depression every week or other week. And so my father would see me skyrocket and he'd try to help me contain myself. But as I said, he would always repeat this one saying. He would say, "Kevin, I'm a banker, not a psychologist." And quite frankly, Greg, my doctor at the time, the day before my attempt, which was really the day before, that was the day I said to myself, I have to die tomorrow. That was the day the quote-unquote decision was made. But I never really call it a decision because I call it a compulsion. I maintain that I never, you know, Kevin Hines never wanted to die by suicide. I believed that I had no other option. And those are two very, very, very different things.
Right.
And so, you know, my father's trying to help me out. He's saying, you know, why don't you come to work with me today? Why don't we go to school? Why don't we go to the beach? We'll go to the movies. Just be with me today, Kevin. I'm worried about you. And then there's me lying through my teeth telling my dad I feel so much better and I'm in a calm state. I'm in a calm state because I believe the pain is finally going to stop. The talking in my head, the hallucinations, the paranoias, the depressions, it's finally going to be over. What I couldn't see was that if I died that day, I would have had a ripple effect on everyone in my life who loved me and everyone in my life who knew me and everyone they knew. If I died that day, my brother would grow up in, I'm sure, an angry state of being for the rest of his life, or my sister would be sad and shallow for the rest of hers, or my parents would be devastated until the end of time. I couldn't see that. That's why when people say suicidal people are so selfish, they have no idea how painful it is to live with this brain pain, this mental illness, as they call it, what I call really a brain disease. They have no idea how crippling it is for not just the brain, but the body. And so, you know, I'm getting to that point. My family, my dad's trying to help me the best way he knows how, but he was on the phone with my doctor the night before. And that doctor said these words, "Pat," my dad's name is Patrick, said, "Pat, it's just another episode. He'll come out of it in a couple of days. Don't worry about a thing." And so what was my dad, the banker, going to do when the professional clinician doctor told him that everything was going to be fine? You know, and so, you know, going through all of that and coming out of it and surviving what I survived, I remember being in the hospital and having the chaplain come to me, and he didn't even know why I was in the hospital. He didn't even know. He didn't check the chart, which he usually did. And he comes in with his black robe and his white robe and his red rosary in one hand, and he looks at me, and he's like the epitome of St. Francis, but with no birds on his shoulders. And he looks at me, and he says, "Hey, kid, what are you in for?" And I kind of stopped for a minute. I said, I jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. And he said, "Oh, yeah, and I'm the Pope." He didn't believe me. He thought I was delusional, which, you know, maybe I was because of all the morphine, but not about that, of course. And he came to my side, he prayed with me, and he said at the end of his prayer, "Kid, when you get better, you ought to talk about this." And I remember looking at him and saying, about what to who? And I had no idea what he meant. And I do know what he meant today. He meant that the power of the spoken word has the ability to do one of two things, hurt and damage, or help and heal. And the right words at the right time with the right message can save lives. That's what I found out. And this journey over the last 15 years has been amazing. I've gone from an attempt that 0.002% of people survive from, to a life lived with great purpose, trying to help other people stay here. And I always maintain, when someone calls me or writes me or tells me or messages me online and says, "You saved my life," I maintain that I didn't do anything. All I did was share a message that you took to your heart, and you, the individual who is saying that I saved life, you actually did the work, the mental health work, the brain health effort to save your own life. You just found the ability and the passion, the drive to say, "Yes, I can. I can stay here." And as I travel the world and talk to people, I realize something, especially in high schools and colleges. The most common thing I hear when I travel is this: "Mr. Hines or Kevin, I have bipolar disorder, or I have schizophrenia, or I have anxiety disorder, or OCD, they say. And they say, "But my family, my mom and dad don't believe it's real." And it's heartbreaking.
Wow.
Heartbreaking to go into every community and hear almost the same thing. That wherever I go, people aren't being listened to, they're being invalidated, and they're being told that they just need to just get over it.
This is especially disturbing because I think we assume that we live in an era now when there is much more openness and understanding about the reality of mental illness than it was the case even 10 years ago, certainly 20 or 30 years ago. But
yeah.
You're speaking of a very sobering reality. What are the key ingredients in you managing your own mental illness as successfully as you have? I suspect that it has been, in a sense, a combination of different factors that has allowed your recovery to be so complete, so successful, although, as you recount in your book, there have been certainly some bumps along the way. Chart your recovery for us.
Bumps are an understatement. You know, 7 psych wards in less than 11 years because of suicidal crisis, because I have chronic suicidal thoughts. And so I would say this. First of all, the field itself of brain health and mental health has come very far in the last 10 years. There's no doubt about it that things are changing, and the tide is moving in the right direction, and more people are talking about it than ever in an empathetic tone. But that doesn't mean there's so many people out there, kids, young people, adults alike, who are trying to fight their depression or their brain pain, and people are just telling them to move on. That's happening. But I'll tell you this. The things that got me able to stay in recovery as I do every day, even now, because I experience every symptom I've ever experienced on a daily basis, it's just that I'm able to cope with them because I know what they are, how they come, how to fight them, and how to keep going. And there are days when I get suicidal. There are days when I don't see the hope, but I always, always, always tell myself that even though I cannot see the hope, I know for a fact that if I just keep walking, it is there. I will find it. I just need time. That's how I look at it. That's how I look at it today. I do that because I do that routine that was told to me so long ago by Time Magazine and my uncle and my family and my friends and my doctors. You know, Kevin, when you have bipolar disorder, the best thing you can do with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, is live your life on a very strict routine. This helps you stabilize the psychosis and the instability within the brain illness. So that routine consists of eating healthy foods, exercising 5 out of 7 days a week, 23 minutes a day, which leads to 12 hours of better mood. Most people don't know that. 23 minutes of rigorous exercise every day leads to 12 hours of better mood. It's amazing. What if you do that twice a day? 24 hours of better somatic wellness. It's phenomenal. So you can do things like that. You can eat healthy foods that feed your brain's nutritious foods that absolutely help the brain in its regular function. You can make sure that if you're suffering with insomnia or sleep apnea or sleep issues or disorders, you get those checked out and righted, because the sleep you get at night, the 7 to 8 hours most people need to thrive, is crucial for me, for example, to continue going. So you've got that. You've got all kinds of great stuff to do. You have to work for it. You have to find the therapies that fit your lifestyle. As long as they're proven, reputable, and appropriate, therapy is in itself talk therapy. Education is to your brain disease if you've been diagnosed. Read everything you possibly can about it so you can fight it better. All of these things can help you heal. And if you're doing them simultaneously or every day, you have a much better chance than someone who is not self-aware enough to recognize that they have to work very hard to survive a mental illness. That's the one thing people don't get. Everyone comes to me and they say, what pill did you take? It's not about that. The medication I take helps me. It doesn't help everyone. Everyone's brain is absolutely different. And so I can't tell you my medication because it might hurt you. It might not be right for your system. But what I can do is tell you that with exercise, eating habits properly, sleep habits really intact, education, and so much more, you can find healing within this battle inside.
Kevin Hines is the author of this fascinating book called Cracked, Not Broken. Before we let you go, say a word about the role that you think your work as an advocate, as an inspirational speaker, traveling the country, as you're going to do in coming to Racine in February, what role you think that has played in your overarching recovery effort? I mean, and at any point, has it been a source of difficulty, or for the most part, has it been only a positive factor in your recovery?
Well, I'll tell you this. It's been an extremely positive factor for the most part in my recovery. Most of the time when I go and I speak and I do work in the field of mental health and I help public awareness campaigns for suicide prevention, and I've actually been doing a lot of film work lately, founded a mental health media company with my wife, 17 Montgomery Productions, and we're putting out a documentary next year called Suicide, the Ripple Effect. And it's had one of the most powerful impacts in my life because I get to travel around the world now with the film and meet people who have changed their lives, a lot of them, frankly, because they heard my story, and a lot of them because they heard other people's stories of hope that are helping people heal. So in doing that, I'm finding this catharsis of kindness, of people saying, I was at the worst of my worst, and your story told me that I could stand up, fight this, beat it, and keep going. And with that, you know, I some years ago, I wrote a 10-step guide to the art of living mentally well. Its nascent stages are in the back of my book, but the newest form of it is actually a program being used by people all over the world. And so all of these things combined and my efforts have given me this boost of life-affirming hope that I can't deny. Now, I'll tell you this. There are some days when I go to a speech and I'm in a lot of pain, and I've just been overcome with either depression or paranoia, oftentimes paranoia, because it's the hardest thing I found to get rid of. And I'm not talking about general paranoia. I'm talking about extreme paranoia where you think everyone in the room is trying to kill you. And when the room is filled with 3,000 people you're about to speak to, that's going to be hard to get on stage and look at these people with the absolute powerful fear that at any moment they're going to hurt you. And so I tell myself through grounding exercises, Kevin, that's irrational. And I do these things. I look at my hand and I say, Kevin, your hands are real. And they're in everyone's reality. Everyone who's looking at you can see your hand as well as you can. But the paranoid delusions, those are in a distorted reality. And those things can't hurt you. So keep going, keep fighting, and keep moving forward.
An important message indeed from the author of Cracked, Not Broken, Surviving and Thriving After a Suicide Attempt. Kevin Hines, thank you so much and very best wishes to you.
Thank you very much.
A reminder that Kevin Hines comes to Racine to speak at Infocino's Banquet Hall, 3201 Rapids Drive, on the 11th of February. He comes to Racine at the invitation of Racine's 21st Century Preparatory School. His talk is part of their series called Dinner and Discussion, their parent community series. You can learn more about Kevin Hines and his story at his website, kevinstory.com. And Kevin wanted to be sure that I added, as this interview aired, that for anybody contemplating suicide, struggling with such thoughts, there is always help available with a toll-free call, 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-8255. It's also possible to text for help in suicidal situations. You can send the text GO, G-O, to 741-741 for free 24/7 completely confidential assistance. But otherwise, that phone call, 1-800-273-TALK. It's 8:31. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two. I hope that you can enjoy, as I have, a book called The Digital Divide, Arguments for and Against Facebook, Google, Texting, and the Age of Social Networking. Our world, our society is changing so rapidly, and particularly for those of us of a certain age who very much remember the world as it once was, it can really be bewildering to think of how much has sort of evaporated into the ether and how much has changed about the way we communicate, entertain ourselves, the way we interact with the world and learn about the world. Mark Bauerlein, a best-selling author, has really followed this this topic and explored it thoroughly in this new book. He is a professor of English at Emory University. He's written all kinds of interesting essays and reviews on the topic. The Digital Divide, available in paperback, is published by Jeremy Tarcher, a division of Penguin Groups. In this, he assembles the writing of a number of key thinkers and really provocative writers exploring this topic from several different angles. And we have Mark Bauerlein with us for a few minutes to talk about The Digital Divide. Mark Bauerlein, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I am glad to join you.
I happen to be, in addition to this life on the radio, a assistant professor of music at our local liberal arts college. So I was really taken by the fact that you happened to write this wearing, among other hats, a professorship of English. And I wonder if you could just say a really quick word about what you have observed among your students and how that has affected the kind of educator that you are and affected the way you do what you do in the classroom on a daily basis.
Well, one of the things I've noticed over the years is that students are more ambitious. They're more achievement-oriented. More of them come to college having logged several AP courses, and they often have professional ambitions. You know, they want to go to graduate school. And so the desire is there, the motivation. But I'm in English. I'm in a humanities field where we're looking at things like becoming a well-read individual, knowing history, getting some historical understanding. So you see the long perspective on things happening today. And in that area, the sort of broad intellectual cultivation, I see a serious deterioration. Students may be ambitious, but they don't care very much about what happened on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in summer of 1963. They don't see how what happened, you know, 100 years ago is supposed to affect them. They're pretty career-oriented these days. And if they don't see a pretty quick payoff, then it just isn't interesting to them. Now, another area of deterioration is reading and writing skills. They don't write as well as they used to, and they don't read as much as they used to. And this comes into digital age habits. I mean, they read and write more words than ever before in human history. I mean, a teenager with a cell phone today averages 3,339 text messages per month, sending or receiving. That's according to Nielsen research. They are constantly emailing and instant messaging or going to Facebook, writing comments, filling out their page. And so the words passing back and forth and the images passing back and forth never stop. But the kind of writing they do and the audiences they do it for and the reading that they do, it's all youth stuff. I mean, 17-year-olds are sending those text messages, and 99% of those text messages are about themselves and their friends. They're doing Twitter posts, if they are, and they're cultivating, you know, these short little blips of a sentence. So when it comes time for me to assign a 10-page research paper, that for them might be equal to writing, you know, a 600-page treatise on something. It's so different. It's so much longer and slower than the writing they're used to. And the reading, I hand them a 250-page novel, and to them, it seems like us, digital immigrants, reading the entire Encyclopedia Britannica. Because all the reading they do is quick, short, you know, chunks of text with, you know, bullet points and visuals and or little tiny text messages. So their reading and writing has just pared down to the fast, easy, and short. And too many academic activities really cultivate the slow, the long, and the plodding. And it's for a totally different audience as well. So what the digital age habits have done is actually make them almost feel estranged from academic work in my field. Reading long books, writing careful papers in eloquent language.
And I can tell you it's done the same in the music field, for instance, on the topic of opera, which I teach, to have a student sit and watch an opera start to finish, or one act of an opera start to finish, or a scene of an opera start to finish, when they are used to consuming their music in much tighter, smaller, hard-hitting chunks.
All right, make them sit for the final exam. They have to spend all week listening to the entire Ring of the Nibelung. Look, and I know this because I grew up in a household in which I woke up to the thundering strains of Wagner, Mahler, or Bruckner all the time.
All expansive composers, for sure. Well, why don't you have one of your colleagues try that at Emory first, and you can let me know how it works. So let's explore a couple things which you say in the introduction to your book, and let's remind our listeners it's called The Digital Divide, and then we'll get to a few of the essays that are also collected in this really fascinating book. You just made mention, and I don't remember if it's in your introduction or elsewhere in the book, about digital natives. I think it actually is Mark Prensky's essay, which is the first in the book, but the distinction between digital natives and digital immigrants. I think this is an important distinction, no matter which characterization happens to fit a given person. It's good for people to know about these two sorts of people in the world right now.
This actually was an important essay. It came out about 10 years ago by Mark Prensky, Digital Natives, Digital Immigrants. And what Mark did was identify a new generation gap. We had the old generation gap in the 60s. The new generation gap opened up in the 90s when he found that young people who were growing up with screens around them, you know, when they're 8, 9, and 10 years old, their classrooms have computers in them. Ours didn't. I'm 52 years old. And Mark said, this means that their minds have developed in a digital world. They're digital natives. Us old folks, we come to these digital tools, including laptops, having grown up in a book world, a paper magazine, paper newspaper world. And so our minds interact differently with these tools than do the digital natives. They're the early adopters of new technology. They're much more facile in their handling of these tools. We're a little slower in picking them up and learning how they work. And Mark's point was that these digital natives should be heeded by teachers. Teachers need to adapt to them. because we can get good, intelligent things happening out of video games. We can make them learn better by using these tools in the classroom. And so he actually comes down on the exact opposite side of the dumbest generation thesis. But I wanted to get him in the book, and I wanted to get intelligent, contrary voices out there, one reason being that this digital revolution is such a confusing and overwhelming thing.
So in other words, the heart and soul of this essay is somewhat contrary to the perspective you take in your best-selling book, The Dumbest Generation. But this book is not about your opinion, as it is about gathering some variant voices on this question of how the world has been changed, and is it changed for good or ill, or what is the combination of the two?
Right. We almost have a little culture war taking place over the nature of these digital tools in people's personal lives. We know that they are miraculous in science and medicine and transportation and logistics and so on. But in people's personal lives, their leisure time, their off hours, do they really improve human life? Do they make people more intelligent, more thoughtful, and so on? That's where the questions lie. And who knows? I mean, I have my opinion, but I know that things are so complicated, and we're in the middle of it right now. So we need to hear a lot of different voices. And this book tries to stage the debate with the smartest people who've weighed in on it. And one of the regrettable things about the internet is that it allows people to groove their contacts. They get news feeds or newsletters or emails, or they make bookmarks on websites that are already matched to what they believe and are interested in. They never need to encounter a voice that disagrees with them if they don't want to. And so you create, you know, one person called it the daily me, so that everything's a reflection of you. And there's something comforting about that. I mean, it's nice to belong. It's nice to feel like your ideas are confirmed. But that's not conducive to intellectual growth. That's conducive to complacency. And so we need to expose people to different sides of complex culture value-heavy questions, such as this one. And in this volume, we've got people all across the board, people who think that Wikipedia is a tremendous advance in collective human intelligence, others who think Wikipedia is the downfall of knowledge. So let's hear both arguments and let people make up their own minds.
I do appreciate something you say about the fact that because this has all overtaken us so quickly in what you call at one point a sign of mass adoption, that one of the things that happens is that we tend not to, in a sense, always fully appreciate it. You write, the popularity of these sites and actions has a paradoxical side effect. They appear altogether ordinary. People use them too much to register for very long their wondrous arrival. Digital tools have proven so efficient and compelling and helpful that it now requires a leap of imagination to recall what life was like before their advent. And, of course, particularly for the digital natives, where this is the only world they know. But even for some of us who are the immigrants, you really have to stop and think about what life was like before email. And we really have to think about our capacity to take these kind of incredible breakthroughs entirely for granted.
I know. A guy was let out of prison in Georgia after being inside for about 30 years. And he was asked, well, what has changed most about your surroundings? And he said, cell phones. Everyone's on these cell phones all the time. Now, we look at people walking by on cell phones and think nothing of it. His perspective is a reminder. This is something so new in the full course of time. It just happened. So we need those reminders. We need to find out what life was like before them, if only to get a little bit of broader awareness of who we are and what we're doing, especially the young. And they are in a position, the digital natives, they've been there all along. The digital immigrants, we remember what life was like if we try hard. We remember what life was like before the digital revolution. But the thing is, we're going to be gone in a few decades. And everyone will have grown up in a digital age from then on. Our memories are going to be quite temporary. And so it's going to take an even greater leap of imagination for the young to see the world. I mean, you know, they'll go into a museum and they'll see an installation of an office from 1984 that had no computers in it. That will be a historical curiosity. 1984. Things move fast, and we assimilate the tools so thoroughly. I mean, I think I mentioned YouTube itself. YouTube is a stunning advent. That you can go look at a video. I can go click and get a little video of Jack Kerouac reading from On the Road on the Steve Allen Show in 1958. That's amazing. But for most people, ho-hum. Oh, yeah, YouTube. Yeah, oh, okay, yeah, just get it up on YouTube. And they might be interested in the content passing through it, the film they're watching. But the website itself is about as ordinary as you know, the dresser over there in the bedroom.
Right, if that.
Yeah.
Back to your introduction. You start out with the story of something in the Wall Street Journal about this very controversial book called Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, in which the author kind of talks about the superiority of Chinese mothers over Western mothers. And, of course, it created a firestorm of controversy. And just on this single website alone, where this article was written about the book, 4,383 comments were logged by various people reacting to it. And you posed the question, is this democratic participation or fruitless vanity? I mean, is there some purpose served by all of those people climbing aboard and stating their own opinion? I mean, if you can't even sort through them all, I mean, nobody would sit through and read many of those things. So what does each one of them, how do they matter? And how are we sort of, how does that affect what we think in the big picture matters in our world?
You know, they did that excerpt from The Tiger Mother, and it's written by an Asian American mother writing about how Asian styles of parenting are so superior to American styles. What are Asian styles? You work, you do your homework, you take your lessons, your music lessons, no TV, no video games, no sleepovers. You know, you get A's or you're in big trouble. The American style, she says, oh, it's about fun. It's about indulgence. The kids come home from school and your first question is, did you have fun today? Well, obviously, this sparked all kinds of controversy. And the thing about the web environment was it only took a few hours for this to start spreading. You saw editorials, op-eds, commentaries on blogs, commentaries going up on magazine websites within a day or two. So it circulated so quickly. And then all those comments at the Wall Street Journal piled up. That 4,000 number, I'm sure it got a lot bigger. It might have reached 6,000 after a few days after I looked at it. And, you know, I had to wonder, if you're reading the story and 4,221 comments have been posted so far, do you really believe that the 4,222nd comment is significant? I mean, do you think anyone's going to look at this? Well, they don't think that way. They just think, I want my voice to be heard. I'm going to say what I think and post it on the Wall Street Journal website. Well, you just wonder, you know, is this a form of the people's voice? or is it just empty gesture that makes people feel good?
And is it fostering some kind of new narcissism that we haven't really seen before exactly in this form? Go ahead.
One thing I've noticed is you know, for a while there, people were talking about the blog, where blogs were really incredible. They're really important. Well, what I looked when I browsed the blog world, the number of blogs that people start and made commentaries that would have zero comments on them, over and over and over again. And I after a while I wondered, why are you doing this? Nobody is listening. No one is paying attention. Now that's sort of an unpleasant message that you want to you tell people. But yeah, one wonders if it's just this is just a matter of narcissism.
Hmm. Andrew Keen's essay is on what some call Web 2.0, the Web 2.0 movement, which he talks about fusing 60s radicalism with the utopian eschatology of digital technology. So he says this is an ideology which worships the creative amateur, the self-taught filmmaker, the dorm room musician, the unpublished writer. It suggests that everyone, even the most poorly educated and inarticulate among us, can and should use digital media to express and realize themselves. Web 2.0 empowers our creativity. It democratizes media. It levels the playing field between experts and amateurs. And those are fighting words for some. I mean, some would really take umbrage at it being characterized like that. I suspect you see some truth in what Andrew Keen is saying there. I mean, yeah. I think you share his concern.
Look, I think that if we want our culture not to sink to the least common denominator, we have to have gatekeepers. And those gatekeepers, one has to acknowledge, are going to have some forms of expertise and some improved abilities to distinguish the good from the not so good. You know, when Andrew did a spot on Stephen Colbert's show, Stephen Colbert says, "So you're saying that, you know, we should keep culture in the hands of just an elite group, people who are knowledgeable and tasteful and so on, while the rest of us are just a bunch of pig farmers." And Andrew didn't back off. He said, "Well, what's wrong with that?" The entire audience booed him. But he was giving an unwelcome truth. Some people are more talented and more discerning than others. And those people should have decision-making power, or we're going to end up with a culture flooded with mediocrity or vulgarity. And unless you try to limit what is allowable, what gets published or what gets produced, what gets filmed, what gets recorded, what can go on the radio, then you're going to end up with piles of mush. Now, it's true, sometimes those elite gatekeepers make mistakes, and they rule out something that could be really worthwhile. And we hear stories about, you know, this book, this great novel being turned down by 20 publishers before one publisher picked it up and went with it. Okay. That certainly happens. But I think those stories are, in fact, pretty rare. And maybe the tragic fact is that the more mediocrity you allow into a space, the more it crowds out superiority. That you can't just open the world to a wonderful marketplace of everything and expect the cream to rise to the top.
Right. As Marianne Wolfe says in her book, the immediacy and volume of information should not be confused with true knowledge, which is sort of a corollary to what we're talking about. I mean, just because something is immediately accessible and there in limitless volume does not necessarily make it truly compelling and worth taking the time. But in our closing minutes, I want to talk about Todd Gitlin and his very, very interesting essay called Nomadicity, in which he sees a lot of what we're talking about as a gravitation that humankind has always had towards portability and miniaturization, each providing a kind of freedom in everyday life. He calls it, at another point in the essay, the right to be somewhere else. That is, when you're sitting in a classroom waiting for class to start, you don't have to be in that classroom. You can whip out your smartphone and suddenly you're, in a sense, someplace else. I wonder if you have any reaction to some of what Todd Gitlin says, or this characterization of some of these new technologies.
Well, I agree with a lot of what Todd says. And one example that I would say is the way in which young people, teenagers today, have a hard time taking a walk through a park, through the woods, across the fields, or through the city without reaching in and getting that cell phone and saying, who can I call? Who can I text? In other words, they can't be alone with their surroundings. They can't simply relate to the presence of things. They've got to make contact somewhere else. They've got to fill this empty space. Well, it's not empty, but they experience it as an empty space. They've got to fill the hour or they feel alone. They don't want to be with themselves. I mean, Todd puts it in one phrase, being with media. And the thing about the word media, mediation, it's being in contact with somewhere else, something else, not present to you at that time. This ties into the capacity of teenagers not to be alone. They don't like solitude. I mean, in a way, adolescence is a lonely period of time, and egos are fragile, and they want to be with their friends. They want to feel like they're not isolated. They're feeling mortality and sexuality come upon them. But one of the acquisitions of maturity is learning how to be alone, learning to be by yourself. And that option is unappealing to them, and they have the capacity to get out, to get away from themselves, to get away from their isolation and connect. Well, that isn't always a good thing.
Sure. And it's also such an intriguing paradox that when you can take your phone with you, that means you don't have to sit by the phone literally waiting for it to ring. I mean, you can go You can go wherever you go, and in a sense, the whole world comes with you. You are always accessible. You are always interruptible. In a sense, you're not getting away at all. I mean, I just love the way in which Mr. Gitlin gets us kind of thinking about this on a different level. And, of course, you've gathered other great thinkers as well, including Nicholas Carr, the author of The Shallows, whom I interviewed on this program, and you include a very provocative excerpt from his excellent book, and many other writers as well gathered together in The Digital Divide, available now in paperback from Penguin. The editor, Mark Bauerlein. Mark Bauerlein, I'm so glad you put this book together. Gave me all kinds of things to think about, and I wish you very well in all of your teaching and all of your writing.
Thank you, sir.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College's Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And a reminder that if you have missed a morning show that you want to hear or want to hear something again, you can easily find our morning show archive right on the front page of our website,